Please proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the court, my name is Kay Parrish and I represent petitioner and appellant Rodney Donaldson in this case. In this case, trial counsel herself testified to and the state court found a fact that was completely contradictory to the record. Specifically, that the two issues, the DNA, the spelling issue into the DNA evidence, and then the issue in terms of racial probability with the DNA evidence, existed in the same murder case that was being tried. That wasn't in different murder cases, in the two different murder cases that were being tried. That was not the case. They existed in the same murder case. Now, this fact was the sole fact and the sole basis for counsel's alleged strategic grounds for her decision to withdraw the motion to sever and for the state court finding of those strategic grounds. From this, we must draw one of two conclusions. Either A, counsel was testifying truthfully as to her thought process at the time of trial, and she based her entire trial strategy on an unresearched mistake of fact, an uninvestigated mistake of fact. Or secondly, her strategy was didn't reflect her thought process at the time, and her strategy, the asserted strategy was merely a form of post hoc rationalization, which again is something that the state court and this court should not accept as a reasonable strategic grounds.
Were there any other grounds to compare and contrast? That seemed to be one of the conclusions that the Missouri court came to, which was that the strategy was to compare and contrast. Are we to read that as only the DNA, or was there a bigger compare and contrast theory on the table here?
The trial counsel in this case was actually very specific that it was the DNA evidence that she sought to compare and contrast. So there was, in terms of any asserted trial strategy, there was no other comparison and contrasting done by trial counsel in an effort to kind of undermine the prosecution's case. It was only with regard to this DNA evidence, and there was no other basis. And as asserted in our briefing, during the cross-examination of the various DNA experts, there were three different experts who testified as to DNA. One as to Cassandra Scott Kate's case, and two to Barbara Hampton's cases. There were no questions. There was not a single question about the DNA in the other case. So in the actual cross-examination, there was no comparison and contrasting being done, no effort to draw distinctions, similarities, or anything like that. Your Honor, I think for that reason, it's pretty clear that the state court's conclusion was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts, a determination of the facts that was contrary to the record in the case. That was the only real factual finding. The two other factual findings which were made by the state court was that this was her strategy, and secondly, that there was some argument made based around that strategy. And because the only thing that had to be done was that was the basis of that strategy was that fact, those other determinations of fact are completely determination of that fact, because that fact makes the entire strategy unreasonable. Your Honor, I also, go ahead.
Excuse me. Let's assume all of that is true, right? Mm-hmm. And then we're still left with this question: is that, you know, the motion opposing joiners already been ruled on, and the decision to withdraw is based on a highly implausible theory that perhaps sua sponte the court's going to now decide to sever these two trials. And at the end of the day, what evidence is there that anything really changed in any way by this tactical decision that was made for an inappropriate or improper or unresearched reason? I mean, because ultimately at the end of the day, we're going to have to look at this case and find out, well, what's actually changed? And if in fact the fighting point is the issue of joinder, Someone's going to have to show, one, the joinder was improper and that the judge abused his discretion. And if you look at Robinson and the cases following that, in this circuit, there's been deference given to judges who decide to join trials for judicial economy. This trial judge did give seven reasons. They seem not to be all made up and pretend. And then at the end, you've got to show that somehow the outcome would likely have been different. And while the district court said that, I'm struggling mightily to see just exactly what the basis is for that and what the understanding was for that. So perhaps you could enlighten me.
Sure, Your Honor, a couple of things. First of all, trial counsel herself testified that she had spoken with the trial judge, and that was why she was concerned that the severance was going to be granted. And Your Honor, I think with regard to, these were two very different cases. In Cassandra Scott's murder, they had all of the evidence they presented at trial in that murder when the crime was first committed back in 2000. And the state did not charge that case until 2005. So just looking at that, you can see the weakness of the case, that when all this evidence initially came in, they didn't even charge the case because there wasn't enough evidence. The only DNA evidence in that case was the DNA that was found in the boxers. And Rodney Donaldson was consistent that he had left clothes there. And there was a very clear alternative suspect, Ronald Dickens, who was a known abusive boyfriend. Ms. Scott had bruises and lacerations all over her body. Mr. Dickens now happens to be under indictment in Tennessee for murdering another wife of his. And there was a lot of evidence that came out, even in the prosecution's case, that this could have been a case of a jealous boyfriend finding the clothes of another man in this person's house. There being a murder that resulted in that. And I think particularly, and Ronald Dickens' DNA was all over the house in Cassandra Scott's case. The only place they found Rodney Donaldson's DNA was on those boxers, which he had consistently said he left there when he was doing work for her. So I think the strength of that case is very, very questionable. With regard to the Hampton murder, the murder weapon itself had DNA of another individual on it for which Rodney Donaldson was excluded. So there was some third individual in that apartment that had the DNA on it that had touched the murder weapon. And we don't know who that was. And we know that it was not Rodney Donaldson. So I think in either of these cases, there is a substantial likelihood that had these cases been severed, had this unduly prejudicial evidence not been come in of the other murders, then we would there would have been a different outcome.
This is Judge Smith. Was the evidence regarding the other individual you mentioned, Dickens, was that brought forth in trial?
Yes. In terms of the new indictment, that didn't come out in the record. That's something more recent. But there was a lot of evidence, and it was brought in through the prosecution witnesses. They had Ronald Dickens testify himself that he had previously had incidences of domestic battery on his criminal record with regard to her. And actually, I'm not sure if they were ever prosecuted, but certainly the police had come. There was a downstairs neighbor, Rodney Donaldson's brother, who had testified that they were constantly fighting. There were bruises all over her body. There were not any bruises on the body in the Barbara Hampton case, which the state's own expert testified suggested that she had been severely beaten before she was killed. So that evidence did come in, and it did come out at trial. And there was a whole other defense available in that case. And to some extent, that was pursued by trial counsel as well.
Counsel, you're making some excellent points about why the chosen strategy was perhaps not the best approach to this case. But what's your best authority for the way the court handled this, the way the state court handled this, was unreasonable?
Your Honor, I think there's a number of cases that I cited to in my initial briefing that talk about a reasonable determination of the facts. I think Miller L. out of the Supreme Court is kind of the foremost decision on what an unreasonable determination of the facts is. And one of the things it talks about in that case is the timing in which things were done, and that giving an idea of whether or not this was pretextual. You never hear anything in this case about comparing or contrasting the DNA evidence until the very first closing argument, but even then it's not really compared and contrast, and then again at the post-conviction hearing. And I think that timing, like in Miller L., suggests a pretextual reason. Additionally, in this circuit, Gabbery versus Steele, and what that looks out is that this purported trial strategy of arguing away the doctor's opinion, that was an issue of allowing in some testimony that shouldn't have been allowed in. It wasn't a strategy that was actually employed by trial counsel, and I think that's what we see in this case. If you look at, there was no real opening statement in this case, but specifically if you look at the cross-examination of the DNA experts, there is no effort whatsoever to compare and contrast this DNA evidence. And the argument is largely focused on undermining the DNA evidence in the Hampton case.
How do we factor in, looping back a little bit to Judge Erickson's question about procedurally where the lawyer was in withdrawing a motion that had already been denied? So do we have to then look to see what, in sort of the prejudice, would we have to conclude based on Missouri law that would have been reversed as a result of the evidence that you've been describing and the way that the trial actually proceeded?
I think that the court needs to conclude that there is a reasonable probability, and because this is a Strickland prejudice standard, so there's a reasonable probability that had trial counsel taken a different action, they would have been severed under Missouri law. And I think if you look at the cases of Brown and Saucy, which I cited in my opening brief, that does establish that reasonable probability. The prejudice standard on appeal, once improper joinder is found under Missouri law, it's almost presumed. If they're improperly joined, in order to determine that evidence of other crimes did not prejudice defendant, the reviewing court must find beyond doubt that the tainted evidence did not affect the jury in its fact-finding process. So I think those cases, Brown and Saucy, establish that. I see that I have 2 minutes and 30 seconds left. I believe the clock was at 15 minutes initially, so I probably want to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Am I right on the time?
Yes.
Okay.
You're correct.
I'll go ahead and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, judges.
Thank you, Ms. Parrish. Mr. Selmans?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Mr. Goodwin on behalf of the warden.
I'm sorry. Name's wrong again. Go ahead, Mr. Goodwin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court cannot grant Mr. Donaldson relief under AEDPA's demanding standard, and because Mr. Donaldson does not deserve habeas relief on the facts of this case. Here, the state court cited Strickland. It set forth the Strickland standard. It applied the Strickland test to the facts of the case and found that Mr. Donaldson had failed to satisfy the required showing under Strickland. That's not contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established Supreme Court precedent. Although the state court's opinion did contain one factual error, the state court's opinion did not rely on or was not based on that mistake. Instead, the state court's decision was based on the fact that trial counsel's strategy was to compare and contrast that DNA report, or those DNA reports rather, from the two murders, and then argue that the DNA from the murder scenes did not belong to Mr. Donaldson. And that's precisely—
Why doesn't that conclusion depend nearly entirely on the factual statement that you've agreed is erroneous, that there was mistake A in case A and mistake B in case B? How could you compare? What would the compare and contrast of the DNA evidence between the two cases be if it weren't relying on that fact, or that erroneous fact? I think everyone agrees now.
Right. So, Your Honor, let me answer your question in two points. The first point is that under Wood versus Allen from the United States Supreme Court, when answering the question of whether there's been an unreasonable application of the facts, the court needs to look at all of the evidence in the record. And when you look at trial counsel's closing argument, she sets forth an explanation or an argument of the case that is completely consistent with what she did at trial. Opposing counsel has, in the brief and here at argument, contended that there should have been more vigorous cross-examination of the first DNA expert. But that would have only served to highlight the fact that Mr. Donaldson's DNA was found in seminal fluid in the boxer shorts immediately next to the dead body. Instead, what trial counsel did was highlight the errors that she found in the DNA report from from Mrs. Hamilton's murder, which was the misspelling of the name, as well as the fact that that haplotype was more prevalent in the Caucasian community and not the African-American community, and then used that to argue that the law enforcement in the case essentially rushed to judgment and made mistakes. And that because of that, and because the state was arguing that the same person committed both murders, that Mr. Donaldson did not commit the Hamilton murder, and therefore that he did not commit the murder of Ms. Scott.
And I don't mean to be splitting hairs, but that almost just seems to be a general, the police didn't do a good investigation and it's sort of sloppy across the board, as opposed to a compare and contrast. Are you still suggesting that that's a compare and contrast?
Yes, Your Honor. And why that's a compare and contrast is it's a difference between the DNA results that were found at each murder, right? It's a comparison between the two cases. That's the defense that trial counsel endorsed at the post-conviction relief hearing, and that's the defense that the record shows that she carried out. And even though the trial counsel was mistaken about those errors being in separate reports, and even though the state court repeated that mistake, clear error under this court's precedents and the United States Supreme Court's precedents is not sufficient for an unreasonableness finding. And so there's not been enough there to get outside of AEDPA's highly deferential standard towards state court opinions. The state court identified Strickland, as I've mentioned before, and applied it to the facts of this case when finding the trial counsel's strategy was reasonable. I know some of the other members of the panel have asked questions about the withdrawing of the motion the morning of trial. The record establishes that a witness was called pre-trial and that a hearing was held on whether joinder was proper or improper, and the trial court found that joinder was proper. The risk of that, if trial counsel is correct, that the trial court would have granted the motion on the morning of trial, that would have plunged the entire trial into chaos. There's no indication in the record about which of the two murder cases trial counsel would have been expected to defend against. And that's a radical change from trial counsel's strategy, all of which is imposed on trial counsel the morning of trial. Strickland tells us that we have to review counsel's actions from at the time at which she made the decision, and withdrawing that motion the morning of trial, if she's correct that there's a risk that it's granted, is a reasonable trial strategy to avoid having to completely change everything, you know, during the state's voir dire. That's not a reasonable
time. Was on the timing, is it undisputed that one of the two trials would have proceeded, or was there any discussion of whether, given that kind of a change, I would guess it would fall, if in fact the district court, the trial court changed its mind and said, no joinder here, these have to be separate. I would be surprised if there were not a motion to continue either from the state or the defense, given that both of their approaches might change as a result. Was there any discussion in that in the transcript?
No, Your Honor. And it was Mr. Donaldson's burden to prove prejudice and deficient performance both in the state court and here in federal court. So where the record is silent, and this is Burt versus Titlow from the United States Supreme Court in 2013, where the record is silent, that's a failure of the prisoner seeking habeas relief, and relief cannot be granted. So to the extent that there's not information in either the trial record, the post-conviction relief record, or the record before this court, that weighs against granting relief to Mr. Donaldson, not towards granting relief to Mr. Donaldson. So in addition to the point that there's not been an unreasonable application of the facts here, there's also not been an unreasonable application of Strickland or a decision that is contrary to clearly established Supreme Court precedent. Your Honor, the United States Supreme Court doesn't require state courts to be aware of or even cite to Supreme Court precedent. It only requires that the analysis that the court does be consistent with, or rather not contrary to, that clearly established precedent, which in this case is Strickland. And the one word that Mr. Donaldson has focused on does not establish an unreasonable application or a contrary to application in this case, because the Supreme Court, the state court, correctly identified the governing standard and made the required finding that trial counsel exercised a reasonable trial strategy.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about the joinder question under Missouri law. What's your view on what would have happened on appeal in Missouri? This is a tough one to sort of warrant, to at least after the fact, after you see all of the evidence come in. Should this have been joined to begin with?
Your Honor, there's a couple pieces of the court's question there. What would have happened on appeal? That question is not directly before the court, because there's not a claim of ineffective assistance of direct appeal counsel. And Mr. Donaldson did not raise a claim that trial counsel was ineffective for not preserving the question. So for this court, what it has to grapple with is the fact that the only Missouri court to review this question, which is the motion court, which made its decision after hearing evidence. This is not a case where there was just argument on a motion. The state produced a witness that testified to the similarities between the cases, and the motion court found there to be sufficient cause under Missouri law for joinder to be proper and for severance to be improper. And this court can't look behind that decision. Severance and joinder is a question of state law, and this court is bound by the decisions of a Missouri court on a state court question. There's ample reasons in this case for joinder, why joinder was permissible, which is why the motion court found so. The murders occurred within a mile of each other. Both women were found murdered in their apartments. Both women were found either without panties or with their panties removed. Both women were found with a strap around their neck or some other instrument to cut off their airway. Telephone cords were found near both women. Liquids were used or near the women to dilute the physical evidence on the women. In fact, an empty bottle of rubbing alcohol, one of which in Mrs. Hamilton's murder had Mr. Donaldson's DNA on it, were found near the women. Both women were acquainted with Mr. Donaldson, although for different reasons. Mrs. Scott worked with Mr. Donaldson. Mrs. Hamilton lived above, or rather below, Mr. Donaldson. And both women were found with kitchen knives, apparently used in the murders. Mr. Donaldson's DNA was found in Mrs. Hamilton's case on the bloody bed pillow where Mrs. Hamilton was apparently murdered. Her body was found next to the bed, in addition to being found on the rubbing alcohol cap. And Mrs. Scott's case, Mr. Donaldson's DNA was found in his seminal fluid on his boxer shorts immediately next to the murder victim. And finally, in Mrs. Hamilton's case, the testimony was that she answered the phone, or was on the phone rather, with her daughter when Mr. Donaldson came to the apartment. She had told her daughter, "Hey, Mr. Donaldson is here." And that's the last person to see her alive. So there's ample...
Mr. Goodman, yes. This is Judge Smith. Was there anything in the record to indicate why, what the 5-year gap in the occurrence of these offenses and then the additional time to pursue a prosecution against this defendant when there was, as you say, significant evidence tying him to the first crime?
Your Honor, if I understand the court's question, the court is asking if there's an explanation in the record for why the state waited to file criminal charges against Mr. Donaldson. And no, there is not an indication. So it's not the case that the record shows, as my opposing counsel has argued, that the state believed the evidence was too weak to proceed to trial. There's simply no information in the record as to why the state of Missouri decided not to bring charges earlier. But again, under Burt versus Titlow, where the record is silent, a silent record does not mean that there are facts that support Mr. Donaldson's claim for relief. That weighs against Mr. Donaldson because he had the burden of proof in both cases. And of course, the 5 years between the two, the passage of time is only one factor under Missouri's joinder law. And so even if that factor weighs against joining the cases, that's not a sufficient reason to grant joinder, or rather to grant severance and to find that there was improper joinder. And for all the reasons that I've just mentioned, in addition to the fact that Mr. Donaldson lied to the police repeatedly every time he was interviewed on either murder, and under Missouri law, that's affirmative evidence of his consciousness of guilt. So that also goes to show Mr. Donaldson's guilt in this case. And all of that demonstrates why there would not have been prejudice in this case had had trial counsel not withdrawn that motion. But of course, the court only gets to de novo review of trial counsel's performance and whether there was prejudice if it does pass through the AEDPA deference. AEDPA is a highly deferential standard. It's a difficult standard to meet. It's meant to be difficult to meet, according to this court and to the United States Supreme Court. And Mr. Donaldson simply has not met that standard in this case. I see that I have another minute left. If there are no further questions from the court, I'll end my argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodwin.
Thank you.
Ms. Parrish, your rebuttal.
Thank you, judges. First of all, my opponent suggests a lot of strategic grounds that were not proposed by counsel, a lot of possible strategic grounds. Counsel did not testify that those were her strategic grounds. It's not this court's job. And I've cited a case law in my briefing which discusses it's not the court's responsibility to come up with strategic grounds, which counsel herself and the record itself did not support. So there was nothing in counsel's testimony suggesting that she wasn't ready for the two cases, or that anything like that would have happened. And there's also, Your Honor, it's correct. There's nothing suggesting that a motion to continue wouldn't have been granted, or that it would have. So there's just too many things we don't know in order to accept those as reasonable strategic grounds when we know the grounds asserted were not strategical. The other thing I want to point out, Your Honor, there was almost no overlap of evidence in this case. So that means, one, these cases could have been tried separately, and the counsel should have been prepared for them. And secondly, that wasn't really a grounds for joining or not severing the cases. Mr. Goodwin suggests that the issue of counsel's failure to preserve the evidence was not raised, but preserve the issue for appeal was not raised. The issue that was raised was a withdrawal of the motion to sever. And what was discussed in that, partly what was discussed and that came out in the post-conviction hearing, was the fact that that operated as a full waiver of the issue on appeal. So I think that issue was properly waived. Secondly, and finally, Mr. Goodwin speaks a lot about this standard under 2254 and the question of whether plausible is the same thing as reasonable. It is not. This was not a painstaking decision. The state court in this case cited Strickland and cited reasonableness, but it didn't go into any of the detailed analysis of what reasonableness is under Strickland. Rather, it equated plausible with reasonable. Reasonableness under Strickland, though, requires a decision among plausible options. And Strickland even uses that language.
I just have one question about that that is sort of procedural that no one's raised, but I went through my mind as I was reading the briefs, that if in fact the claim is that the Missouri Court of Appeals decision is not a reasoned opinion. Do we look back at the original trial judge's first habeas hearing and look at that as the first reasoned decision of the court, or the last reasoned decision of the court?
And Your Honor, I'm out of time. You want me to go ahead and answer?
You can answer the question.
Okay, thank you. Your Honor, I think the law on that is that you look at the last reasoned decision of the court. And I think that's particularly appropriate in this case because I don't think the original circuit court's decision can be considered a final decision. There's suggestion in the record that it was under reconsideration. It was not a decision. It was not an issue that was raised in the new trial motion. And under Missouri law, an affirmative waiver like that waives even plain error review on appeal. I think the habeas law suggests that that we look at the last reasoned decision of the state courts. But with regard to the underlying severance issue, I don't think the circuit court can be considered a final decision. And I do think there's plenty of precedent out there for evaluating these issues, even when the circuit court, the initial circuit court, is ruled against you. So thank you, judges.
Thank you, Ms. Parrish. Thank you also, Mr. Goodwin. The court appreciates both counsel's presence before us this morning. We appreciate the argument that you've provided and the briefing that's been submitted, and we will take the case under advisement. Councilman.